10,000-year-old barrier island. Also, at least one undescribed species was dominant in the studied area. Thank you for your attention.
The broad title of my research is Role of Housefly in Ecology of Antibiotic Resistant and Virulent Enterococci. Antibiotic resistance is a serious threat in clinical medicine. So when the antibiotics actually were introduced around 1940s, since then there has been several reports that bacteria are getting more and more resistant to all the available drugs. Actually, this picture gets very scary when we find a report about some infectious agent like Staphylococcus aureus. And one report shows actually more than 90% of the Staphylococcus aureus are multiple drug resistant by 2005, where all of them they were susceptible around 60 years back. So this is a serious public health issue, and only due to this antibiotic resistance, the estimated cost in USA $5 to $24 billion per year. So if we want to look back, what is the reason behind the development of the resistant bacteria? We can see that 30% of the total produced antibiotic in USA are used for the human being, and 70% of these antibiotics are used in the agriculture.
So today I'm going to be talking with you about creating an outdoor classroom, a university high school service learning partnership. So first of all, I want to start off with just a basic definition of service learning. Service learning is an experiential pedagogy, a teaching and learning strategy that integrates meaningful community service with instruction and reflection to enrich a student's learning experience, teach civic responsibility, as well as strengthen our community. So really, really, really taking instruction out of the classroom. So service learning always has these common characteristics. It's always positive, or really should be. It should be meaningful, and it should be real to the participants. It should be cooperative rather than competitive. Promotes teamwork and citizenship. So students that are enrolled in service learning classes really get involved with the learning, really develop an ownership. It engages problem solving in a specific context of service activities and community challenges. We really try to address community needs, not what do I think the community needs, but listening to the community and then addressing those problems. And it must always be mutually beneficial and sustainable. So a little bit of background about Athens-Clarke County, where the University of Georgia is located. Athens-Clarke County poverty rate is the third highest in the country at 28.3% in comparison with counties of approximately the same geographical size. One out of every four kids in Athens-Clarke County lives in poverty. When the UGA student population is accounted for, the poverty rate remains 23.5%. And 39% or 36,000 citizens within Athens-Clarke County, where the University of Georgia is located, live below the poverty rate. The dropout rates in Athens-Clarke County are incredible. 19% or nearly 10,000 residents do not complete high school. 59% graduation rate. 8.1 yearly dropout rate. Disaggregating data in 2007 says that 50% of all African American students will not graduate, and 42% of Hispanics. So this is a community issue that really needs to be addressed. In 2003, Athens-Clarke County school system tried to address this situation by creating a new school, a non-traditional high school called Classic City High School, a Performance Learning Center. This was created a partnership between communities and schools, which is a nationwide program, the Clarke County School District, as well as the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. It is non-traditional. It is voluntary. And students actually do receive diplomas. It's targeting at-risk students or dropouts. So students are at risk. Things go on in their lives. A lot of these students are parents. So this gives them that second chance. A lot of students just don't flourish in a traditional classroom. So once again, this gives them an opportunity to have a little bit of different instruction. Courses are, for the most part, electronic. They're online. And they do have elective courses such as entomology, which is where my program was started. School is Monday through Thursday, and it's 10 to 5. So the school really tries to cater to students who have jobs or have to support families or other things like that. And I really like the school motto, rigor, relevance, and relationships. There are about 100 students in this school, and there's a one-on-one relationship with mentors through the community as well as community partners. So in 2005, there was a partnership developed between the entomology department and the entomology class that's being offered at the high school to encourage dialogue and service learning projects. Every fall, there's an entomology class taught at Classic City High School. Part of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation is that every student in that school has to do 100 hours of service learning. So a student is selected to come to the University of Georgia and participate in our spring service learning class, Entomology Outreach and Service Learning. And then as a culmination of that two-semester experience, one student is selected to attend our study abroad course in Costa Rica, all expenses paid. So some of the service learning projects that we've done at the Classic City High School, 2 years ago we developed an apiary, or beehives there at the school. We always do a lot of entomology outreaches in the community, so these high school students and undergraduates at Georgia, as well as graduate students, go out in the community and share entomological knowledge. They help us with our annual insect zoo, which attracts probably about 500 people to the department. When we do our international outreach, they actually go into schools in Costa Rica and teach about insects. And then some of the collections that the students do while we are in Costa Rica are donated to schools. Classic City students, they have an insect collection requirement. So they wanted to bring more insects to campus. It's very difficult, as we all know, to do labs, and they have very limited facilities. So they were trying to think of creative ways. How can we bring insects to campus? Our Classic students, they researched insect-attracting plants, and this kind of evolved into the idea of developing an outdoor classroom. So the objectives of the outdoor classroom are to promote interdisciplinary service learning, and to provide a learning space to give students an appreciation for the natural world, increase students' interest in science, the arts, and of course, civic action. So educators' top 10 reasons. I'm not going to read through all of these, but it's very clear that getting students out of the classroom is a very positive experience. So our methods. I collaborated with several faculty at the University of Georgia, and we developed a grant and received grant funds for a seed project, including art, entomology, horticulture, and landscape architecture. Both high school, graduate, and undergraduate students were involved in this project. All the partners met for a brainstorming session. We really wanted to know what the high school students want. This is their space. How do they envision this outdoor classroom? So ideas for that were all brought together, and then the landscape architecture students actually created a master plan. So this is the high school, and one thing that I will add, about a year ago, the high school started a daycare. Like I mentioned, a lot of these students are parents, and they had to drop out of school to take care of their children. So now these parents, these young adults, can come to school, their children are watched during the day, and they can take classes and finish their degrees. So landscape architecture, they have a charrette, or a very intensive design session where the master plan developed. So this was the master plan developed by the landscape architecture students. The students really wanted to, since it's an entomology class, they wanted to have different habitats. So they wanted to have an aquatic habitat. That was really important to them. So this was an aquatic bog garden. And if you notice, there's a rain barrel on the side to collect water from runoff. And then, of course, we wanted to provide some classroom space. So here you can see some sitting area, so students can go out and sit in the gardens and do really any subject that they offer at the high school. So the art education piece, there was a graduate level art education class that got involved in this project, and they really wanted to focus on a couple of different themes, identity being one of them. This is one of the high school students, and this is kind of telling. This is a young gentleman that is, for all intent and purposes, had a very difficult life. And so you can see himself at the bottom of the mountain, and he has so many obstacles in his way. This was another student at Classic City High School with her art project. And then one last student. Art can transcend the distance formality of aesthetics and dare to respond to the cries of the world. If you can see, this says choice. This young gentleman lost one of his brothers about 3 years ago. But one thing that his brother always told him is that you always have a choice. So some of the outcomes of this project. Grant funds, that initial seed grant, were used to purchase garden supplies. The project is actually currently on hold because the high school will possibly be moving in the next year. We've also applied for additional funds for this project. So some of the student reflections, because it's really important in service learning that we take time all throughout the course, before, during, and after, to really, really capture what's going on with the students. So I'm just going to read through some of these. My stereotypes of at-risk students has changed. I thought dropouts were just lazy. Many of these kids have had extremely difficult lives. I can't imagine dealing with school, having to support a family, living in poverty, having no transportation, but these kids are succeeding. The students at the PLC were so excited about the Outdoor Classroom Project. It was neat working with so many different disciplines. As I mentioned, horticulture, landscape, architecture, entomology, and art education all came together around this one idea of the Outdoor Classroom. Nothing like I've ever experienced before, a true collaboration. Last, I felt like I was a part of something bigger, much bigger, that is truly going to make a difference in people's lives. Are there any questions?
Where they are mainly used to the food animal, either primarily as a growth promoter or as prophylactic or to treatment the infection. And this extensive use and misuse of antibiotics puts a continuous selective pressure on the microbial community, where the bacterial community actually, they transfer the genes, the resistant genes on mobile genetic elements within the same species or to the different genera. Some insects, like the field flies, they develop on the animal manure, and the gut microbial community of these insects actually adapt to the antibiotic pressure by extensive transfer of degradative genes. And some of these insect gut might provide a hot spot for the horizontal transfer of resistant genes through the mobile genetic elements such as plasmid or transposon. There are actually already several evidences that insect might provide the perfect condition for horizontal gene transfer in their gut. One paper just came out about housefly, and they showed that housefly gut can provide the conditions for the horizontal transfer of resistant genes, and also virulence gene Shigatoxin 1 among the Escherichia coli strains, which is a gram-negative bacteria. Some other studies have been done on Columbola or on Bombyx mori larvae and the plague vector fleas also. So my research question was, can housefly digestive tract provide the condition for the horizontal transfer of antibiotic resistant genes? And my objective was for this study to determine the potentiality of horizontal gene transfer among Enterococcus faecalis in housefly digestive tract based on this hypothesis that horizontal transfer of resistant gene can take place in the fly digestive tract. So my insect of interest is housefly because they develop in decaying organic material which has a rich and diverse microbial community. And they are already been associated with lots of potential foodborne pathogens such as Campylobacteria jejuni, Escherichia coli, Vibrio cholerae, or Salmonella. I use Enterococci as a model bacteria in my research because that is a gram-positive coccus, and there has been no paper published about the horizontal transfer of resistant genes among the gram-positive bacteria in housefly gut. Normally, Enterococci are the normal flora bacteria of animals and humans, and Enterococcus faecalis and Faecium, they are actually clinically the most important species because they are the third leading cause of nosocomial infection, that is a hospital acquired infection in the intensive care unit in USA. And they can acquire very easily the frequent and multiple antibiotic resistant genes. They have a great number of mobile genetic elements. Also, they are able to transfer these genes to even more pathogenic bacteria such as Staphylococcus aureus. Generally, the bacteria actually develop antibiotic resistance by genetic mutation, or they can acquire the resistant genes by three different processes: transformation, transduction, or conjugation. And I adopted the principle of the pheromone responsive plasmid conjugation, the principle of these technique, and that is the best study system in Enterococcus faecalis, where you can see there is one recipient cell one recipient cell, which actually is able to release the sex pheromone. Actually, that is for some people the sex pheromone is kind of too much, so they change the name. That is now the a polypeptide pheromone, and that interacts with the pheromone responsive plasmid in the donor cell, and that plasmid actually then can release, induces the synthesis of the aggregation substances on the surface of the donor cell, and these sticky substances causing the clumping of these cells, and when the donor cell actually contacts the recipient cell, they form a pouring channel, and then donor cell, they transfer the plasmid to recipient cell, and as a result we get the transconjugant. So for my study, I used two different Enterococcus faecalis strains. The donor strain had rifampicin antibiotic resistant gene on the chromosome as a marker, and tetracycline resistant gene on the plasmid as a marker. Recipient cell actually had streptomycin resistant gene on the chromosome as a marker, and I used three different corresponding media to isolate donor, recipient and transconjugant. So how did I do that? First, I took the surface sterilized pupae and divided them into two groups. I took one group when the flies emerged. I gave donor inoculum to one group of flies, and after 12 hours, I switched them. They received the recipient inoculum for 1 hour, and then actually I separated them in different petri dishes. Another group got the recipient first. For 12 hours, and then the donor, and then I separated them into different petri dishes. Every day I took 5 flies from each group. I dissected the labellum of the mouth first, and I surface sterilized the rest of the fly body to eliminate all the bacteria from the surface. And every day I processed labellum, the rest of the fly body and water for the following 5 days. And I process them on the selective media for donor, recipient and transconjugants. So here comes the results. This results actually shows where from the flies, they got donor first and recipient second. So as you can see in the graph, the orange bar actually shows the transconjugant concentration, and just after 24 hours of exposure of the inoculum, I isolated transconjugant from labellum and from the rest of the fly body, and again I isolated transconjugant on day 2 and day 3 and day 4 in a very consistent manner. But the results were most interesting. I found the result most interesting when I processed the water sample. In the water, I did not find any transconjugant on the day 1. First, they showed up in the water in day 2, on day 2 and then day 3 and day 4. But the most important thing here is that I found the transconjugant from the fly first, not from the water, and this result clearly indicates that the transconjugants are developing in the fly, not in the water. This is the result that from the fly, they received recipient first and donor second, and similarly as the previous result, first I isolated them from the labellum and from the fly on day 1. And then I found them only from the fly day two and day 3 and day 4. When I did the water sample, then I found actually the transconjugant on day 2 first and then day 3 and day 4. But every time actually the concentration was a little less in the water, and first time I found them in the fly. So I think this indicates that the transconjugant, again, they're developing in the fly, not in the water. And the flies actually, they might contaminated the water. So can housefly digestive tract provide the ideal condition for horizontal transfer of resistant genes among Enterococcus faecalis strains? The answer is yes. With the high frequency plasmid transfer with antibiotic resistant genes, and this gene transfer is very fast, and transconjugant appear within 24 hours. I got more transconjugant in donor DR group than from the flies who got donor first and recipient second. 52% flies were positive for transconjugant in that group than RD group. And though this is not a good news for us, as you can see in that cartoon, but my results indicates actually another aspects of housefly, which makes them more important vector as public health perspective. I want to thank my professor and my committee member and the financial support grant, and thank you all for listening. Hi.
Hi. Yes. I have a couple questions.
Yeah.
So, what evidence do you have that it is a congregation that's going on in the neighborhood and not, especially with the stuff that we do? If the donor first, recipient second situation works better, because a lot of those donors get life and then a lot of free DNA there, can't they just get transformed? I didn't know if you were going to talk about it.
Actually, when we do the surface sterilization, that actually we kill all the bacteria from the surface, from the leg and from the whole body surface. So only the place they can survive in the digestive tract.
Right. Right. But no, my question is, how do you know they're conjugating?
Oh, because
the donor picking up naked DNA from live bacteria. I know that they're surviving.
That principle actually we are using, that donor actually we did kind of like other. This is in vivo assay, but we did other in vitro assay. There actually we do the clumping assay, and then the donor actually they transfer the plasmid. That's their conjugation process. That potent donor cell, they transfer that plasmid to recipient when they get that sex pheromone, when they release the sex pheromone. They do kind of conjugation. That's actually a very well-studied system, and that's actually you can do in media, in liquid broth, or on the plate.
Do you think that
Yeah, sure.
And because it's in the water, they keep reinfecting themselves, so they're going to keep defecating.
Actually, I think that is a possibility, but you know, first they are developing in the fly, that's for sure.
Right.
But maybe, yeah, some because, you know, I cannot control the feeding, because this is not like a mice or rabbit that I'm feeding them. So flies actually, they feed on water. So definitely, maybe some of them, they didn't have that, but then they picked it up from there. But I think the most important thing here is like a day where they are actually developing. And that is another thing maybe for your first question, that there, this conjugation is very specific. So Enterococcus faecalis, so far, they only transferred to another Enterococcus faecalis strain, not to even Enterococcus here or some other species of the same genus. No, no. Like all the time, we do some other clumping assay, but all the time, Enterococcus faecalis, they can transfer the plasmid only to other Enterococcus faecalis recipient cell. Only within the same species.
All right, so the group of crickets that we work with in my lab are the Alamobia associates complex, or ground crickets. It's a pretty awesome group, actually. So over about the last 30,000 years, we have three species that have diverged and radiated across North America. So we have a northern form, the southern form, and then this new guy down here in Texas and Louisiana. The thing that really makes the system quite powerful is we have two contact zones. So we have a hybrid zone between these two species and a hybrid zone between these two species. So we can actually look at the traits that isolate these guys, and my postdoc advisor and myself have been looking at these for quite a while. They're quite easy to collect, so it's random highway driving. Get off the side of the road, go to a ditch, collect, and take a picture of the rest area, then move on to the next rest area, take a picture, you know, go to the bathroom. It's great fun. Over the course of about the last 20 years or so, persons have looked at a whole different range of isolating traits. So they've looked at all of these. I'm not going to read them. So behavioral things, ecological things, and post-zygotic things. And it turns out none of them are important. Okay, but yet, where they occur in sympatry, they remain distinct and bimodal. Right, so hybrids are rare in nature. So what explains that? What turns out that things like conspecific sperm precedence. So let's say a female mates with a male of her own species and a male of another species. The male of her own species ends up fertilizing most of the eggs. That's self-explanatory, I think. The ability of a male to induce a female to lay eggs. Okay, that's another kind of thing that isolates these species. And we call these post-mating prezygotic traits. Okay, so that's what we do. We lump them together as post-mating prezygotic traits. And so now we're going to have fun with anatomy. And so where do we see these kinds of things taking place? Well, in this case, it's going to have to be in the reproductive tracts, right? So it's after copulation, but before the zygote is formed. And so in this case, what's cool about these guys is they actually produce an external ejaculate. So I'll use the little pointer here. So that thing, okay, which is the spermatophore, which I guess would be that thing right there. And what's great, your ejaculate is packaged, right? So all the sperm are in there, all your seminal fluid proteins are in there, and you can pull it from the male and not have to worry about it, right? Because they'll just keep producing them and producing them and producing them. So non-destructively getting at these ejaculates, which is just wonderful. So we look here. This is an abdomen. I guess I should use this thing. This is annoying. So abdomen. These are the testes that were pulled out. And this is the accessory gland, right? The thing that produces all the seminal fluid proteins. It's proportionally correct, okay? That's not blown up or whatever. The abdomens of these guys are just packed full of reproductive tissue. There's no room for really anything else. I don't know how they eat. They're just packed full of reproductive tissue. It's wonderful tissue, a lot of great stuff. So they mate. What happens here? Females mount males. Here's a spermatophore.